a place in the
you
World Cup.
For us.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Fox Football Podcast. I'm Adam Peacock. Great to have your company. And if you're enjoying your football wherever you are around the country, hope you are. And for those in the parts of the country that can't quite get out there at the moment, it'll be over soon. And hopefully you'll be back to playing the sport that you love very, very soon. And that's kind of the topic of discussion today, this week on the Fox Football Podcast. I'm joined by a man who's down in lockdown in Victoria, but trying to find ways through and helping players get through this tough period to make sure that they don't miss out on too much so that when they get back out there, they can be the player that they want to be. He's a coach. He's worked in the A-League. He's now with Lang Warren down there in the southeast suburbs of Melbourne. Scott Miller is my guest today. Scott, thanks for your time. How are things?
Mate, very good. We've got a bit of energy. The Premier was good enough to allow us to leave the home the last couple of days. So I'm actually back at work and back on the training ground, which is good. But it's not been easy. 8 weeks. The last 8 weeks we've been locked up in our homes, essentially, with an hour of exercise a day. So I'm a pretty patient person, but I've also loved my exercise and training. So it's been difficult. So I can only imagine some young players that are really missing playing football.
Yeah, and that's the topic of discussion today. Like, you've got a lot to do through your business that you've set up, Identity Pro, and also your work there at Lang Warren with younger players coming through and trying to better themselves every single day. And in various parts of the country earlier in the year, they went through this with the fact that they couldn't get out and they were taken out of the team environment. For young players especially, male and female, how would you judge this season and what it might do for their future prospects of making it in the game and what they might be able to do to better themselves regardless of the situation?
Yeah, I guess it's a case of mindset for me. We've lost this year. You'll never get it back, essentially. But the questions I've been asking the players I work with individually is, how have you substituted your time and how could you be most effective? And the ones that said, oh, well, you know what, I can't do anything. I can't go and train. So I'm not going to do anything. It was always a challenge. And I had to get them shifting away from the practical component of the game to the learning environment. And we do tasks every week. We choose a Premier League game, for example, and we watch it individually. And then we do a Zoom call later that week about key areas of the game, whether it be in possession or out of possession. So my point being, you can always think laterally as well. Because I align this, and I've used the analogy with these young players about, consider when you're injured as a senior player and you can't train, how are you going to maintain your motivation and how can you continue to develop? And I've always used that analogy over the last 8 weeks. Consider this time that you aren't physically able to train and how can we improve your game? And that's been really positive for them. So utilizing small tools like match analysis and also strength and conditioning and basic IP work, that's been the main thing as well. But the challenge I've seen is sustaining motivation. And Adam, we've speak a lot about players and why we ask ourselves, why do the best players make it? And for me, it's not just their technical attributes. It comes down to the fact they can sustain motivation to work. So I flipped it with these players. I say, how strong are you and how determined will you be? Don't use this as an excuse. It's not a barrier. Let's change our mindset and be creative with what we can do at this time.
Because a lot of players will be feeling that it's a lost year. A lot of parents of these players, and I'm talking about youth players at the moment particularly, would feel like it's a lost year. Players 20 to 22, 23, the same as well. In your opinion, is it a lost year for everyone around the country?
Well, the thing that is consistent with that statement, everyone has lost a year. So, and although Victoria's been locked down for periodically a bit longer time, we've all lost the opportunity to play as much as we can. Now, if we lived our lives in our normal business life or just football sense, that if we can't do something, we're not going to be progressive and not going to improve, well, I'm sorry, we're all going to stand still. The fact is, our reality is we couldn't play football this year. So I think the language that parents can support their child is move on quickly from it. And how can we move on in a positive way? I know I have. I kept myself fit and active during the lockdown because I thought, well, the minute the green light goes on again, I'm back on the pitch. I need to be fit. I need to be active. And that kept me in a positive mindset. From a technical perspective, yeah, we've missed out playing games. But I don't know about you, Adam. I've known you a few years now, and I know you're a high energy and positive person as well. Well, what are you going to do, guys? Are you going to sit at home and wallow in the fact you've missed 20 games this year? Or are you going to make sure that this is your biggest preseason, starting now by getting the fittest you've been, mentally aware of your role and other people's roles in the game by watching Liverpool and Manchester United on the weekend, and being progressive? Adam, that's my mindset in coaching. Don't look back, look forward, and how can you improve differently? Because the last time I checked, COVID is global and everyone's in this similar situation. So we've all been hit. So for me, it's about how you talk to yourself, and it's got to be a case of move forward now and leave it in the past and let's get going for next year.
Yeah, you've got contacts all around the world. How has this affected them and their preparation and their development as well, that the similar scenarios we're seeing here with younger players and overseas as well?
Oh, everywhere. I mean, I've spoken to all my friends in England and Scandinavia and Spain, for example, and they've been hit. They really have. And clubs have had to become so resourceful via technology to engage with their players, whether it be small home programs, whether it be injury prevention programs. And it hasn't been easy, but I get back to how players make it as elite athletes. And, you know, having got a son that plays football as well, Adam, you'll steer him and provide him opportunities, but his motivation and his drive to become an athlete at the best level will only come from him. And yes, he'll have these surrounding measures around him to guide and support, but that's the challenge young players have now all around the world. It's the mentality towards self-motivation, because they don't have the coach critiquing him and pushing him in training. So it's purpose-led and intrinsic motivation. There's nothing else. So how are you going to spend your time during school holidays? Playing FIFA or improving your technique in the backyard? That's the way it has to go. It has to be so intrinsic, and your desire to work independently during this time is difficult. But let's face it, if you want to play for Tottenham or Manchester United, it's only you that's going to get you there, essentially.
Have you been reading stories about how the best, I mean, we saw those stories in lockdown where Jose Mourinho was trying things with the Spurs players. He got in trouble a couple of times.
Well, I saw, yeah.
Staying in contact with your players, but not being, in a way, too overbearing, being the helicopter coach where you're giving them too much and you're not letting them kind of just, you know, deal with everything that's going on. Have you seen stories overseas about ingenious ways of staying in contact without overdoing it?
Yeah, I've seen numerous ways, and I know examples from Scandinavia. I've spoken to a number of people, and it's been social as well. They've done like cooking classes online as well. And it sounds mad for you, right? But if you're talking about a full-time job in a professional sporting environment, you're spending so much time with each other, whereas you've gone from that to nothing and spending time at home. So yes, you're doing the IP programs, the conditioning programs at home, and maybe sneaking down to the park with the gaffer, I don't know. But that, in reality, it's, you have to be creative. I've certainly got the mindset of minimal contact with the right detail, because I want my players to become self-sufficient, because let's face it, on the pitch, they'll have a game plan, but they need to make good decisions. They need to be self-sufficient. So if we hold their hands too much during this time, are we taking the decisions away from them? Humour. Massive amounts of humour. I've seen WhatsApp groups from groups all around the world, and the banter and the humour, and just connect with players as well. Because let's face it, it is a hard time for everyone. And we're fortunate we live in a great country, but some of these countries and people I speak with, they're in some countries without the infrastructure, and it's very difficult. But you've got to get creative as a coach.
With the technical aspect of, you know, we've spoken about this in the past before. Good players become better players by training with other good players. So they don't have that parameter at the moment to be able to bounce off other players and improve themselves on a you know, three times a week down at training. In some parts of Australia and other parts earlier in the season as well. So how do you improve or make sure a player's technique is being worked on while you don't have that face-to-face contact?
Yeah, well, I guess whenever you sign a player, you do a medical screening, for example. So there's no difference to when you do your technical screening as well. So, you know, a lot of the coaches I speak with down in Victoria, they ask my advice regarding things like this as well. And I'll go back to the motivation first. Players are motivated by competition. You know, if you speak to your son and myself, we love the competitive side. we've taken that away from them. And they're in their backyard on an independent way, training with a ball and some cones. So I've spoken to a lot of coaches and I've said to them, make training competitive at home. So time challenges, contact challenges, and set a weekly challenge where your players have to video it and send it back in and announce winners at the start and the end of the week and get sponsors on board and give them things for incentive. But create the competitiveness outside of training, inside the technology to keep your group interacting as well. So there's so much we can do. But in terms of the technical attributes, it comes down to your principles of play, but you can no longer do that in a team orientation. But, you know, we look at the South Americans and the top players in Europe, they're so good with the ball at their feet. So the contact time and curriculum we speak about, I spoke about this with the other day, a kid being in the backyard, using his imagination, bouncing the ball off the trees, the fences, and being creative. I'm sorry, Adam, football, you have to make decisions under pressure. So when it's so scripted and I receive the ball from here, back foot, and I play here, that's not a reality of the game at times. We have to make decisions. And a part of that is your own drive and determination. But I'll tell a famous story. I remember I went to Real Madrid years ago and with a player called Mohamedou Diarra. And he was a Galactico and an amazing player. And we signed him at Fulham. And he had to go to Spain for a few weeks. So I joined him on one of those I'll help you trips, right? One of the best. So all expenses paid. We trained 3 or 4 times a day and ate beautiful food at night, right? You're sitting at a dinner table with a Galactico in Real Madrid. You feel like a rock star. So it wasn't a bad couple of weeks. But we would train at Real Madrid training ground every day because he's a god there. And the first day we pulled up, we're getting driven there in this car and the driveway to the training ground is quite long. And I see this stick figure miles away, this tiny little figure training, bang, hitting these balls. And I said to him, I said, who's that? And he says, it's Cristiano. I said, who? And he goes, Ronaldo. And I went like that. I looked at my watch and it was like 7:15 in the morning, right? And I said, what's he doing? Because in Europe, training usually starts at 10:30. Players in for 8:39, training 10:30. It's basically a part-time job. It's the best job in the world, starting at 10:30. So, he's out there at 7:15 and I'm thinking, what is this? What's going on? He goes, every morning, he'll be there.
Every morning.
Majority of the time, it's either in the gym or on the pitch every morning. And this was back in 2012, I think Mohamedou Diarra joined us. So he's obviously conditioned to do that. And then we would go and do our gym work and then he would come in and join the rest of the team for breakfast and he's already done a session. And that was Ronaldo. And I think, right, okay, so we're talking about COVID and the impacts of training or lack of ability to do it. And then I'm looking at one of the best players, if not the best players in the world, training by himself at 7:15 when he's got everything in the world that he needs. So that for me is inspiration enough. And I tell that story to kids and they're like that. They don't want to go home. They want to train every day because that's what it takes. Forget COVID. Get out and train when and when you can.
That then, and I've heard similar stories of him at Carrington at Manchester United, where they've physically had to go out onto the training ground an hour after training and carry him to the training ground because they're fearful that he'll rip a quad and he'll be out for the weekend, for instance, when he's pinging these free kicks left, right and centre or doing stupid sprints over the other side. And he's doing it on the far pitch for a reason because he's far away because he knows someone will come out and get him. But that to me, and he's a famous example, is a guy that, in his brain, he's almost scared of not being the best. And he's that motivated to prove himself. And it's probably why he rips off the shirt to show everyone his rig when he scores a goal. He's showing everyone about how good he is. And he wants to, he's essentially, his career is about showing off and showing off how bloody good he is. And that's his mindset every single day, probably when he gets up, is that I want to show someone something that they've never seen before. And I'm going to do it by working as hard as everyone. Now, obviously, you've worked with a lot of players in your time. Not everyone's like that. Is that a natural thing, do you think, that he's just had that from a very young age through his upbringing that he perhaps didn't get the love that he wanted or something happened in his upbringing that he's trying to prove something every single day to someone else?
Oh, well, he doesn't rely on a fear of a manager critiquing his performance to perform. He doesn't rely on incentives. Although he gets all the incentives in the world. And when you look at a player that's working by himself, that's just pure purpose. Whether it's come from his background as a young player, whether it's come from hardship or people not believing in him, his internal motivation is to be the best. And, you know, we've spoken of Jordan, we've spoken of all these key players that have got that ability to internally motivate. And there are so many stories of this guy. And I guess, you know, the discussion recently I've heard a lot of is players' fear of getting injured, and I don't want to do too much. And you know me well enough, Adam, my pathway started as a sports scientist and fitness coach, and the fear of player availability and fitness and can't get injured, overload and stuff like that. I go, well, I'm not sure about you, but see, when I was living in London, I didn't warm up to run for the bus or the train when I was running late. I ran for it and I got it. And I didn't turn the gates over and do dynamic flexibility beforehand. I just went and got it because I didn't want to be late to get to work, right? So this fear of overload is an interesting and curious one for me with young players as well, because Ronaldo does more than anyone, but he plays the majority of games. Rarely is he injured. So I ask myself, he is conditioned to train and play at that level, and he's not training with any fear of getting injured. And that's a mindset as well. A lot of young players are so fearful of overload now. Extend your body mentally and physically to see how far you can push yourself. Because he's testament of how far the body can be pushed. What age is he now? 37?
A bit younger, yeah.
36, yeah, thereabouts, I think. Mid-30s, and he is in the better condition. I could only imagine the dressing room, Adam, when he walks in with his top off and he absolutely banters those young boys and just says, how's your body fat at 22? Imagine. Are you sure you want to eat that for breakfast? You're out of order. Because if I had, I remember we had a couple of players. Swartzy was one. See, when Swartzy came to Fulham, his body type changed. Our nutritionist got hold of him for fun. And he was at Middlesbrough, big guy. And then you'll know this. When he came back and joined Fulham, his body, I haven't seen a body like it, like a goalkeeper. It just suddenly went bang. He had like footballs on his shoulders. He was enormous. And his body fat reduced. And he tells me famous stories when he went to the national team camps. He basically got stuck into the rest of them about their nutrition and their focus and what they're eating before and after games and stuff like that. You know, and that's his internal motivation to play the length he did.
How would you describe the physicality, preparation and abilities of our young players? Because, good friend of ours here at Fox Football, not a good friend of everyone. He attracts a bit of criticism for his opinions, but he's always got an opinion and he sticks by it as well. Robbie Slater reckons that, the physical side of things, and he still does like 1,000 push-ups a day. He's a lunatic. He's fitness personified. He reckons our younger players aren't quite up to speed in terms of it's gone too far the other way, working on too much isolated technique rather than actually preparing them as well to be athletes as well as footballers. What do you reckon?
Do you know what? I'm glad you said that because it's almost a case of the model's gone from the football fitness has to occur in training, which I agree with. I mean, I could count on one hand the amount of times my players ran without the ball last year. However, Robbie's right. Whether or not everyone thinks he's right, I agree. The mentality of work and pushing yourself so far outside of your boundaries or your perceived boundaries is so important, because I've worked under some extreme managers that push their players to the point of just breaking point. And if you're a player and you are in an environment like that, you're going to have to be so mentally strong. And if you haven't tested those boundaries whilst you're a young player, you're never going to know what you can achieve. And I've said to the players during this period of time that I work with, I said, use this time to test and measure what works for you. What works before training from a nutrition perspective and games? What works for your body with recovery after training? But also find out how hard you can push your body. You're not having to recover for a game or anything like that. So throughout the week, let's test ourselves mentally and physically how far we can go. So I'm a bit like Robbie. I love the push-ups and I'm running every day. I'm a machine as well. I love training and that's just my thing. I just love it. I grew up with that intensity in me of working hard. It's gone too far. The overload and the training load. Do you know what? You only become as strong as how hard you push yourself. And the body's pretty durable, but the mind will let you down beforehand.
I'm a big believer of that particular statement. And I'm not saying let's all get the kids out there onto the sandhills or let's take them for 10K road runs. You can do it within the parameters of a football pitch still with footballs involved and
Sure. Picking
it up and having the football involved a lot, maybe not all the time, but a lot still. But it's a definitive point, and it'll be interesting to see how that develops over the next couple of years. What else have you been passing on to your players? And you've got a program I mentioned at the top there, Identity Pro, that you've a very individual based set up with mindset. And how resilient, and the mindset of the Australian player compared to, say, the mindset of the players that you're working with in Scandinavia and Southwest London at your team time at Fulham. I'm generalising here, but is there some points we can make about where it's all at in terms of reference to here and overseas?
It's very individual, but quite some time ago, I moved away from goal-orientated view. So I stayed away from setting targets and goals for the individual. And I actually run this program called Winning Mentality. And it's around building an individual winning mentality. And if I said to you now, the definition of winning mentality meant everything and totally different to every single player, that would be the case. It's not just the desire to want to win every game and the ability to do it. It's how you prepare, how you recover. It's your focus to do so. So I wanted to call it that because if you want to be an athlete, the end point is you need to win games to sustain that. That's the fact in competitive sport. It's about winning, but sometimes you lose. And the reaction to sometimes how you lose is pretty poignant as well. So we really focus on behaviours as opposed to goals. So if I said to you, Adam, what's your goal for next year? You're a 14-year-old striker and you tell me I want to score 20 goals and 4 assists. Great. Okay, that's your goal, but you've got referees, weather, your teammates, a goalkeeper, an opponent trying to stop you. So how are you going to feel if you don't achieve that at the end of the year? Well, I'm not too sure. Right, so I then turn it around and say, let's talk about your behaviours instead and create some foundations. So get the discussion around how consistent are you going to be in games? And it might be, I'm going to commit to being hardworking. I'm going to commit to leading my team. I'm going to commit to being positive. And the response I've had from the players is so much more significant because instead of the getting in the car after the game and the dad saying, oh, you didn't score today, the dad's saying, hey, how did you go today? How were your behaviours? Did you work hard enough to your level? Were you committed? Were you focused? And the discussion is about progression instead of commentary, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And it supports player development. So these programs have been highly successful because it creates an internal Bible. And it's a great document for the players because it's on their phone in a PDF and they can look through it and it becomes their script on how they correct and how they motivate themselves for performance instead of just looking and hoping for the best. Because, you know, one of these things when one of the worst things I hear with players is when they say, oh, I need to play well today. That worries me because they're focusing on the outcome and the outcome can be affected by so many things. I love when a young player goes, you know what? I'm going to work so hard today, irrespective of the result. I'm going to support my teammates. I'm going to be positive. These are things he can control.
Yep.
And if you've got 11 young boys going onto the pitch with their own personal identity within a game plan, and it's a collective, you're going to move more progressively and positively as a team.
As a rule, where do you think players improve the most? Is it through a high volume of training? And like I said before, good players training with good players to become better players, or is it games and they learn the most through playing games? Where do you sit with all of that?
Well, it's funny you ask because one of the first things we do with players is do a learning assessment. So we assess their learning style and we assess what motivates them through a questionnaire. And as a coach, if you don't understand how your players learn and you're communicating to the group in one manner, you're going to find it quite challenging because you're going to see deficits in learning styles and understanding. So first of all, the learning has to be individual, there's no doubt, and also understanding how they're motivated as well. So in regards to that, Adam, that's a tricky question because we test and measure our outcomes in training in games. So you see some form of element, but the problem with that is the minute we stick competitiveness attached to development, there's resistance. So referee, opponent, goalkeeper, weather. So those factors can be overridden. And sometimes the outcome may have been there, but because we're so fixated on development and performance and then potentially winning because everyone likes to win, we might not see the actual picture. So the biggest thing I've always said to players, if if your club films your games, you need to be watching your game the day after and analyze it, because you're looking at it with different emotion and you're reviewing your performance. And I wouldn't say too many kids are doing that. And it's probably one of the first things I'd suggest. They need to watch their game, Adam. Watch their game back and in isolation of their position in and out of possession. And for me, that's the hardest thing about development. How do you measure it? The coach's ego wants to win. Although he's a motivator and he's a development coach, I know your philosophy is, you know, expanding the knowledge of the game instead of just win, win, win. That's a component of it. But you want a development. You want to see a matured player going through the ranks at your club.
Yeah, I'm a big proponent of the idea that if you develop the kids in the right way and you play the right style of football that you want to play, there's half a chance that you're going to win some games. And if you do it that way and push them with that carrot, the result not looks after itself, because as you mentioned, there's so many factors in football. But the number of times I've spoken to my boys about after a game we've won and we haven't played the way that perhaps we want to play, and we're like, not disappointed, but like, hey guys, there was certain things about that performance that needs improvement. Okay, you won, happy for you. And there's other times that we've come off after the pitch, we've battered a team, we've had 10 shots to two, and we've gone beaten 2-1. It's like, yeah, sure, there's little bits of improvement that we should be putting away some of those 10 chances, but we play well, guys. And if we keep doing that on a consistent basis, it's not blindly going in saying performance is everything, but yeah, I'm a big believer in trying to get them to play in a certain way that's going to help them when they're 18, not right now, if you know what I mean.
I started this quite a long time ago, and it was, you know, when you put a game plan in place and you'll know this as a coach of your team, and you say, guys, we all understand our positions in and out of possession, and they'll all look at you and go, yep, we do, yeah. Right? But what information are they taking in? They're taking in their perceived information you want. And you see a lot of coaches, they're very autocratic in their responses as well and how they deliver their game plans. But to measure players' development, it's all about guided discovery and question. And there's nothing better than asking leading questions to hear your players describe how you're going to press in a game. And the minute my teammate, if I'm a young player, is describing how we're pressing, and the second and third phase on the back of that, the coach is standing there gaining some wisdom because he's listening to it instead of talking. And once your team are discussing the tactics, yes, you're there to correct the information if it's slightly wrong, but you're there to guide the discussion. And I've had some great results with that, especially with young players and young teams, because if they're saying it, Adam, they can articulate it. Well, they've grasped what you're saying. So instantly you're gaining wisdom about, one, they understand the game plan, but two, they can educate one another, which tells me in a game when the wind's howling and they can't hear the coach, they can instruct one another.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's learning. And that's what my fascination, you know, worked in the A-League was a great privilege, but developing the next level of player and youth, you can have such a big impact, not only as people, but just as young, talented footballers. It transcends into so many other avenues.
So just on that one that we mentioned before about learning games v training, so you would say that the learning through games, yeah, it's important, but it's only really solidified if there is a review after it by the player to try and pick out what he or she could be doing better or what he or she did well, so that they can try and repeat it next time.
Yeah, for sure. And you're looking for that consistency. And, you know, if we start from our reality, if we're developing players, we're developing them for competition. So you wouldn't starve them of that lack of competition. It doesn't make sense. We need our players to make decisions under pressure, and we need them to respond to certain aspects of the game. So we need that measurement of a game, there's no doubt. But you're spot on. I mean, the analysis, I can't speak of it enough. Match analysis for me is one of the biggest components, and is only as strong as your training ground work. If you're filming your training every day and reviewing your sessions and games, it's so powerful, because when you look at the learning styles of players, and I'll give you this analogy, you know, when you're on the tactics board and you're in full flow and you're moving them things around and you're buzzing because you know everything you're talking about, and then your assistant coach tells you afterwards, they hadn't a clue what you were talking about. right? We've all been there because we know what we know and we're trying to interpret what we think they know. Mm. And that's one of the first things I do with the playing group. I determine, you know, are they creative learning styles? Are they intellectual? Are they practical? And the minute you determine that, you can communicate with them differently. So if your touch points are pre-match video, practical, audio, visual, and then you go onto the training ground to replicate that meeting practically, you see what I'm saying? You're capturing all audiences of how they are learning, and coaches need to be doing this. Yeah. You know, I think 75% of kids are practical learners, but what about the intellectual ones, the accountants of the word, then it's all logical, detailed. So when they're seeing carnage on a screen and it's all audio and visual, he just wants systematic logic, pass here, run here, squeeze here, press here. And you're missing a whole demographic of player. Mm. And that's our beauty of a job as a coach and how versatile and possibly underpaid we are for our skill set.
Possibly, but we get things out of it in a different way. Hey, just in a general sense, say pick the time point of 10 years ago when you were working with Fulham at the very top level, as a coming through and then you watching a lot of football now, watching a lot of top level football and working where you are as well. What are the trends? What are the trends that football has become that you'd describe in the last 10 years to where we are right now and how it's been played?
That's a big question. Can I have a little subtitle with some form of direction where you'd like me to take that? That's a big question because I've seen it from going physically. You could answer it from a physical perspective. The game's off the charts. I mean, I recently did an analysis of all the top five leagues from a physical perspective, and we looked at the comparisons from total distance, high intensity, and sprint distance across French, Spanish, English. And we saw disparities with certain areas. So the speed of the game's gone through the roof. The physical maturation of players, you see them getting bigger. There's more time spent in the gym. They're stronger, they're bigger, they're more powerful. Technically, the game is totally different in terms of speed.
Better?
And some, what's that?
Better, technically?
I would have to agree. I think the minute you correlate speed and technique and the speed is quicker, you're probably going to suggest, well, physical attributes have to be more robust. Players have to be more powerful to execute the same skill at a higher speed. And I'm not saying all games, but the games I've watched with Liverpool, example, the way they break, the way they press, some of the technique with ball at people's feet is astounding. So it's changed a lot. It's changed a lot, which sort of pushes me back to Robbie's statement about work rate and desire and ability to work. If young Australian footballers are listening and their desire is to play in Europe, you are really going to have to sustain some form of work rate and get to a level where you are pushing your boundaries far beyond you think you can work. Because I've experienced that, Adam, in some of the training sessions. I used to join in as a 26, 27-year-old. And I'll tell you what, I was in the hyperbaric chamber and the cryotherapy chamber for a good 2 hours post-session because they are electric. The speed is phenomenal.
Just on that though, the speed's one thing, but the understanding of space and how the game's played, should that bit not be skipped over as well in the development phase in particular? And do you feel it is perhaps sometimes skipped over still?
Yeah, big time. I mean, my first experience of coaching in MPL started 2 years ago, and I really had to educate my team here about rhythm of the game, and it's very big in Europe, rhythm. So we're winning 2-0. Are we going to counter every time? Can we slow the game down? And a clear understanding of how potentially physiology of your body works. You know, enabled to sustain intensity, we need to recover at times. And John Terry and Frank Lampard were the biggest. I remember playing Chelsea the first time, and you could hear John Terry shouting to the team, recover with the ball, recover with the ball, recover with the ball. And you would see him take the ball and it would go centre back to centre back and they would split wide and the team would get into their starting positions and he would rotate the ball across, across, across numerous times. And then the minute you'd feel it, the rhythm would change back into, right, we are ready to play. Our starting positions are committed, but physically we're recovered. Mm. Now, for me, that's a mentality and an understanding of the game rhythm. And I don't see that enough in Australia. I think it's sometimes very much like ping pong. I'd probably beat you at ping pong. I love it. You'd be pretty handy, wouldn't you?
Well, you're so freaking competitive, you'd make sure of it, yeah.
Oh, we'd have a good go. But so it's the reality is the game understanding is so important, especially for kids, you know, and there's nothing better, Adam. You know, you coach your team down there at Manly, and the ability when you see a quality young player put his foot on the ball and slow the tempo of the game down and pass it somewhere that's not advantageous to score, but advantageous to retain possession and maintain possession. Now, for me, that's skill, it's technique, and it's game understanding. And it's the best to see, right?
It's intelligence. It's football intelligence. It's very hard to teach someone to be intelligent, I find. It's
cool. You've tried?
I've tried it with myself, and it hasn't worked. So,
no, you're all about power. I've seen your videos in the top bins. I was just very cautious about the cars behind the goal there with no netting.
Well, that's the beauty of Instagram, mate. You just choose the best one out of 20.
Oh God, I thought that was only one. Mate, you just let the cat out the bag.
Well, you can tell by all the balls that are scattered behind everywhere in the bushes and up against the fence. Yeah, but anyway,
good left peg on you.
Yeah, I don't have a right. No, it's for getting on the bus and getting off the bus. Hey, one last one. So what would you advise, especially young players again, but even your pros at or your semi-pros playing at NPL level, about getting back into it? And okay, this season has been one of confusion and a state of flux. So getting out of it, and then when November, December comes around, when your mind's all of a sudden on March, and yes, we're going to get back onto it, what would you advise?
Well, my first thing would be ask yourself this question. Do you love football and do you want to play? And that's obviously two questions into into sort of one line. And if you answer those really honestly and your desire and passion is to go and play, go and do it and have fun. You know, I think the foundations of the next 6 to 12 months in anyone's life around the world is find something you love, go and do it to your best ability and have fun, because it's been such a hard year for everybody. And it's funny, when I start to hear 12, 13-year-olds and I ask them why they play football and they tell me it's a release and an escape, that worries me, right? Because you and I used to play football because we used to love it, not because we're removing ourselves from another position. So kids need to get back to be playing football for fun and enjoyment. And guess what? With that passion, the development will naturally come, because the more you do something with that passion, I'm a big one for that. I've mentioned that word numerous times, but without that energy and focus, nothing will occur. And in final, move on from COVID. It's affected every single person. As a society, we're potentially going to have to live with it long term, but let's not fall victim to it continuously. The game is such a good game and it brings so much joy to everyone.
Too easy, mate. One last one. Your old club going to get relegated 4 games in, Fulham?
I've got a confidentiality agreement there, mate. I can't say. I'm not sure. Listen, geez, I feel for Scott, because he's an absolute gentleman. And I remember the first day he walked into when he signed for Fulham, he walked in and he picked up the magnets off the tactics board and started telling Martin Yol how to play. I thought, oh God, this is in 2012. He walked in to shake hands and say, welcome to the club type stuff. And he's basically put his coat on and just, you know, parked in his car park. I'm thinking, calm down, Scotty. Anyway, but you knew back then that he was very much a tactician. I want them to stay up for more reasons than not, whether or not they've got the right playing group. You can see deficiency straight away in their back four. But he's not a silly man, and he knows how to set a team up. He may have to evolve his philosophy a little bit and maybe condense how they press at times, but let's see. Who knows?
What did Martin Yol say when he did that?
Hey, Scotty, sit down. Yeah. Yes, your tactics are good from afar, but far from good, Scott. Sit down.
Could you imagine doing that to a Mourinho, for instance?
Far out. Maria, well, yeah, listen, I don't think you do it with any manager. I think you just get yeared off.
Mate, good story to end with. Scott Millett, thanks very much for your time on the Fox Football Podcast, and good luck with the coming months with your players down there in Melbourne, and good luck getting out of lockdown, first and foremost.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. One thing I'm looking for is just I'm a bit of an introvert and an only child, just one pint in a beer garden by myself with no space invaders. I can't wait.
Good luck.
Cheers, mate.